It's a good thing you came, said Ivan, as though brooding, and not hearing Alishaw's exclamation. I knew he had hanged himself. From whom? I don't know. But I knew. Did I know? Yes, he told me. He told me so just now. Ivan stood in the middle of the room, and still spoke in the same brooding tone, looking at the ground. Who is he? Asked Alishaw, involuntarily looking round. He's slipped away. Ivan raised his head and smiled softly. He was afraid of you, of a dove like you. You are a pure cherub. Dmitri calls you a cherub. Cherub. The thunderous rapture of the seraphim. What are seraphim? Perhaps a whole constellation. But perhaps that constellation is only a chemical molecule. There's a constellation of the lion and the Sunday, don't you know it? Brother, sit down, said Alishaw in alarm. For goodness sake, sit down on the sofa. You are delirious. Put your head on the pillow, that's right. Would you like a wet towel on your head? Perhaps it will do you good. Give me the towel, it's here on the chair. I just threw it down there. It's not here. Don't worry yourself. I know where it is. Here, said Alishaw, finding a clean towel, folded up and unused, by Ivan's dressing table in the other corner of the room. Ivan looked strangely at the towel. Recollection seemed to come back to him for an instant. Stay. He got up from the sofa. An hour ago I took that new towel from there and wetted it. I wrapped it round my head and threw it down here. How is it it's dry? There was no other. You put that towel on your head? Asked Alishaw. Yes, and walked up and down the room an hour ago. Why have the candles burnt down so? What's the time? Nearly 12. No, no, no. Ivan cried suddenly. It was not a dream. He was here, he was sitting here, on that sofa. When you knocked at the window, I threw a glass at him. This one. Wait a minute. I was asleep last time, but this dream was not a dream. It has happened before. I have dreams now, Alishaw. Yet they are not dreams, but reality. I walk about, talk and see, though I am asleep. But he was sitting here, on that sofa there. He is frightfully stupid, Alishaw, frightfully stupid. Ivan laughed suddenly and began pacing about the room. Who is stupid? Of whom are you talking, brother? Alishaw asked anxiously again. The devil. He's taken to visiting me. He's been here twice, almost three times. He taunted me with being angry at his being a simple devil and not Satan, with scorched wings, in thunder and lightning. But he is not Satan, that's a lie. He is an impostor. He is simply a devil, a paltry, trivial devil. He goes to the baths. If you undressed him, you'd be sure to find he had a tail, long and smooth like a Danish dog's, a yard long, dun color. Alishaw, you are cold. You've been in the snow. Would you like some tea? What? Is it cold? Shall I tell her to bring some? Kustani parmeteran chayandi hors. Alishaw ran to the washing stand, wetted the towel, persuaded Ivan to sit down again, and put the wet towel round his head. He sat down beside him. What were you telling me just now about lies? Ivan began again. He was becoming very talkative. I like lies. I said something nasty about her. It was a lie. I like her. I am afraid for Katya too, Moro. I am more afraid of her than of anything. On account of the future. She will cast me off too, Moro, and trample me underfoot. She thinks that I am ruining Mitya from jealousy on her account. Yes, she thinks that. But it's not so. Too. Moro the cross, but not the gallows. No, I shan't hang myself. Do you know, I can never commit suicide, Alishaw? Is it because I am base? I am not a coward. Is it from love of life? How did I know that Smerdyakov had hanged himself? Yes, it was he told me so. And you are quite convinced that there has been someone here? Asked Alishaw. Yes, on that sofa in the corner. You would have driven him away. You did drive him away, he disappeared when you arrived. I love your face, Alishaw. Did you know that I loved your face? And he is myself, Alishaw. All that space in me, all that's mean and contemptible. Yes, I am a romantic. He guessed it. Though it's a libel. He is frightfully stupid, but it's to his advantage. He has cunning, animal cunning, he knew how to infuriate me. He kept taunting me with believing in him, and that was how he made me listen to him. He fooled me like a boy. He told me a great deal that was true about myself, though. I should never have owned it to myself. Do you know, Alishaw, Ivan added in an intensely earnest and confidential tone, I should be awfully glad to think that it was he and not I. He has worn you out, said Alishaw, looking compassionately at his brother. He's been teasing me. And you know he does it so cleverly, so cleverly. Conscience. What is conscience? I make it up for myself. Why am I tormented by it? From habit. From the universal habit of mankind for the 7,000 years. So let us give it up, and we shall be gods. It was he said that, it was he said that. And not you, not you? Alishaw could not help crying, looking frankly at his brother. Never mind him, anyway, have done with him and forget him. And let him take with him all that you curse now, and never come back. Yes, but he is spiteful. He laughed at me. He was impudent, Alishaw, Ivan said, with a shudder of offense. But he was unfair to me about lots of things. He told lies about me to my face. Oh, you are going to perform an act of heroic virtue, to confess you murdered your father, that the valet murdered him at your instigation. Brother, Alishaw interposed, restrain yourself. It was not you murdered him. It's not true. That's what he says, he, and he knows it. You are going to perform an act of heroic virtue, and you don't believe in virtue, that's what tortures you and makes you angry, that's why you are so vindictive. He said that to me about me and he knows what he says. It's you say that, not he, exclaimed Alishaw mournfully, and you say it because you are ill and delirious, tormenting yourself. No, he knows what he says. You are going from pride, he says. You'll stand up and say it was I killed him, and why do you writhe with horror? You are lying. I despise your opinion, I despise your horror. He said that about me. And do you know you are longing for their praise? He is a criminal, a murderer, but what a generous soul. He wanted to save his brother and he confessed. That's a lie, Alishaw? Ivan cried suddenly, with flashing eyes. I don't want the low rabble to praise me, I swear I don't. That's a lie. That's why I threw the glass at him and it broke against his ugly face. Brother, calm yourself, stop. Alishaw entreated him. Yes, he knows how to torment one. He's cruel, Ivan went on, unheeding. I had an inkling from the first what he came for. Granting that you go through pride, still you had a hope that Smerdyakov might be convicted and sent to Siberia, and Mitya would be acquitted, while you would only be punished, with moral condemnation. Do you hear? He laughed then, and some people will praise you. But now Smerdyakov's dead, he has hanged himself, and he'll believe you alone. But yet you are going, you are going. You'll go all the same, you've decided to go. What are you going for now? That's awful, Alishaw. I can't endure such questions. Who dare ask me such questions? Brother, interposed Alishaw. His heart sank with terror, but he still seemed to hope to bring Ivan to reason. How could he have told you of Smerdyakov's death before I came, when no one knew of it and there was no time for anyone to know of it? He told me, said Ivan firmly, refusing to admit a doubt. It was all he did talk about, if you come to that. And it would be all right if you believed in virtue, he said. No matter if they disbelieve you, you are going for the sake of principle. But you are a little pig like Fyodor Pavlovich, and what do you want with virtue? Why do you want to go meddling if your sacrifice is of no use to anyone? Because you don't know yourself why you go. Oh, You'd give a great deal to know yourself why you go. And can you have made up your mind? You've not made up your mind. You'll sit all night deliberating whether to go or not. But you will go, you know you'll go. You know that whichever way you decide, the decision does not depend on you. You'll go because you won't dare not to go. Why won't you dare? You must guess that for yourself. That's a riddle for you. He got up and went away. You came and he went. He called me a coward, Alishaw. The motto long is that I am a coward. It is not for such eagles to soar above the earth. It was he added that, he. And Smerdyakov said the same. He must be killed. Katya despises me. I've seen that for a month past. Even lies will begin to despise me. You are going in order to be praised. That's a brutal lie. And you despise me too, Alishaw? Now I am going to hate you again. And I hate the monster, too. I hate the monster. I don't want to save the monster. Let him rot in Siberia. He's begun singing a hymn. Oh, too, morrow I'll go, stand before them, and spit in their faces. He jumped up in a frenzy, flung off the towel, and fell to pacing up and down the room again. Alishaw recalled what he had just said. I seem to be sleeping awake. I walk, I speak, I see, but I am asleep. It seemed to be just like that now. Alishaw did not leave him. The thought passed through his mind to run for a doctor, but he was afraid to leave his brother alone. There was no one to whom he could leave him. By degrees Ivan lost consciousness completely at last. He still went on talking, talking incessantly, but quite incoherently, and even articulated his words with difficulty. Suddenly he staggered violently, but Alishaw was in time to support him. Ivan let him lead him to his bed. Alishaw undressed him somehow and put him to bed. He sat watching over him for another 2 hours. The sick man slept soundly, without stirring, breathing softly and evenly. Alishaw took a pillow and lay down on the sofa, without undressing. As he fell asleep he prayed for Mitya and Ivan. He began to understand Ivan's illness. The anguish of a proud determination. An earnest conscience. God, in whom he disbelieved, and his truth were gaining mastery over his heart, which still refused to submit. Yes. The thought floated through Alishaw's head as it lay on the pillow. Yes, if Smerdyakov is dead, no one will believe Ivan's evidence, but he will go and give it. Alishaw smiled softly. God will conquer. He thought. He will either rise up in the light of truth, or he'll perish in hate, revenging on himself and on everyone his having served the cause he does not believe in, Alishaw added bitterly, and again he prayed for Ivan. Book 12 A Judicial Error, Chapter 1 The fatal day at 10 o'clock in the morning of the day following the events I have described. The trial of Dmitry Karamazov began in our district court. I hasten to emphasize the fact that I am far from esteeming myself capable of reporting all that took place at the trial in full detail, or even in the actual order of events. I imagine that to mention everything with full explanation would fill a volume, even a very large one. And so I trust I may not be reproached for confining myself to what struck me. I may have selected as of most interest what was of secondary importance, and may have omitted the most prominent and essential details. But I see I shall do better not to apologize. I will do my best, and the reader will see for himself that I have done all I can. And, to begin with, before entering the court, I will mention what surprised me most on that day. Indeed, as it appeared later, everyone was surprised at it, too. We all knew that the affair had aroused great interest, that everyone was burning with impatience for the trial to begin, that it had been a subject of talk, conjecture, exclamation and surmise for the last 2 months in local society. Everyone knew, too, that the case had become known throughout Russia, but yet we had not imagined that it had aroused such burning, such intense, interest in everyone, not only among ourselves, but all over Russia. This became evident at the trial this day. Visitors had arrived not only from the chief town of our province, but from several other Russian towns, as well as from Moscow and Petersburg. Among them were lawyers, ladies, and even several distinguished personages. Every ticket of admission had been snatched up. A special place behind the table at which the three judges sat was set apart for the most distinguished and important of the men visitors. A row of armchairs had been placed there, something exceptional, which had never been allowed before. A large proportion, not less than half of the public, were ladies. There was such a large number of lawyers from all parts that they did not know where to seat them, for every ticket had long since been eagerly sought for and distributed. I saw at the end of the room, behind the platform, a special partition hurriedly put up, behind which all these lawyers were admitted, and they thought themselves lucky to have standing room there, for all chairs had been removed for the sake of space. And the crowd behind the partition stood throughout the case closely packed, shoulder to shoulder. Some of the ladies, especially those who came from a distance, made their appearance in the gallery very smartly dressed, but the majority of the ladies were oblivious even of dress. Their faces betrayed hysterical, intense, almost morbid, curiosity. A peculiar fact, established afterwards by many observations, was that almost all the ladies, or, at least the vast majority of them, were on Mitya's side and in favor of his being acquitted. This was perhaps chiefly owing to his reputation as a conqueror of female hearts. It was known that two women rivals were to appear in the case. One of them, Katerina Ivanovna, was an object of general interest. All sorts of extraordinary tales were told about her, amazing anecdotes of her passion for Mitya, in spite of his crime. Her pride and aristocratic connections were particularly insisted upon. She had called upon scarcely anyone in the town. People said she intended to petition the government for leave to accompany the criminal to Siberia and to be married to him somewhere in the mines. The appearance of Grushenka in court was awaited with no less impatience. The public was looking forward with anxious curiosity to the meeting of the two rivals, the proud aristocratic girl and the hetera. But Grushenka was a more familiar figure to the ladies of the district than Katerina Ivanovna. They had already seen the woman who had ruined Fyodor Pavlovich and his unhappy son, and all, almost without exception, wondered how father and son could be so in love with such a very common, ordinary Russian girl, who was not even pretty. In brief, there was a great deal of talk. I know for a fact that there were several serious family quarrels on Mitya's account in our town. Many ladies quarreled violently with their husbands over differences of opinion about the dreadful case, and it was that the husbands of these ladies, far from being favorably disposed to the prisoner, should enter the court bitterly prejudiced against him. In fact, one may say pretty certainly that the masculine, as distinguished from the feminine, part of the audience was biased against the prisoner. There were numbers of severe, frowning, even vindictive faces. Mitya, indeed, had managed to offend many people during his stay in the town. Some of the visitors were, of course, in excellent spirits and quite unconcerned as to the fate of Mitya personally. But all were interested in the trial, and the majority of the men were certainly hoping for the conviction of the criminal, except perhaps the lawyers, who were more interested in the legal than in the moral aspect of the case. Everybody was excited at the presence of the celebrated lawyer, Fetyukovich. His talent was well known, and this was not the first time he had defended notorious criminal cases in the provinces. And if he defended them, such cases became celebrated and long remembered all over Russia. There were stories, too, about our prosecutor and about the president of the court. It was said that Ippolit Kirillovich was in a tremor at meeting Fetyukovich, and that they had been enemies from the beginning of their careers in Petersburg, but though our sensitive prosecutor, who always considered that he had been aggrieved by someone in Petersburg because his talents had not been properly appreciated, was keenly excited over the Karamazov case, and was even dreaming of rebuilding his flagging fortunes by means of it, Fetyukovich, they said, was his one anxiety. But these rumors were not quite just. Our prosecutor was not one of those men who lose heart in face of danger. On the contrary, his self, confidence increased with the increase of danger. It must be noted that our prosecutor was in general too hasty and morbidly impressionable. He would put his whole soul into some case and work at it as though his whole fate and his whole fortune depended on its result. This was the subject of some ridicule in the legal world, for just by this characteristic our prosecutor had gained a wider notoriety than could have been expected from his modest position. People laughed particularly at his passion for psychology. In my opinion, they were wrong, and our prosecutor was, I believe, a character of greater depth than was generally supposed. But with his delicate health he had failed to make his mark at the outset of his career and had never made up for it later. As for the president of our court, I can only say that he was a humane and cultured man, who had a practical knowledge of his work and progressive views. He was rather ambitious, but did not concern himself greatly about his future career. The great aim of his life was to be a man of advanced ideas. He was, too, a man of connections and property. He felt, as we learnt afterwards, rather strongly about the Karamazov case, but from a social, not from a personal standpoint. He was interested in it as a social phenomenon, in its classification and its character as a product of our social conditions, as typical of the national character, and so on, and so on. His attitude to the personal aspect of the case, to its tragic significance and the persons involved in it, including the prisoner, was rather indifferent and abstract, as was perhaps fitting, indeed. The court was packed and overflowing long before the judges made their appearance. Our court is the best hall in the town, spacious, lofty, and good for sound. On the right of the judges, who were on a raised platform, a table and two rows of chairs had been put ready for the jury. On the left was the place for the prisoner and the counsel for the defense. In the middle of the court, near the judges, was a table with the material proofs. On it lay Fyodor Pavlovich's white silk dressing gown, stained with blood, the fatal brass pestle with which the supposed murder had been committed, Mitya's shirt, with a blood-stained sleeve, his coat, stained with blood in patches over the pocket in which he had put his handkerchief, the handkerchief itself, stiff with blood and by now quite yellow, the pistol loaded by Mitya at Perhotin's with a view to suicide, and taken from him on the sly at Mokro by Trifon Borisovich, the envelope in which the 3,000 rubles had been put ready for Grushenka, the narrow pink ribbon with which it had been tied, and many other articles I don't remember. In the body of the hall, at some distance, came the seats for the public. But in front of the balustrade a few chairs had been placed for witnesses who remained in the court after giving their evidence. At 10 o'clock the three judges arrived, the president, one honorary justice of the peace, and one other. The prosecutor, of course, entered immediately after. The president was a short, stout, thick, set man of 50, with a dyspeptic complexion, dark hair turning grey and cut short, and a red ribbon, of what order I don't remember. The prosecutor struck me and the others, too, as looking particularly pale, almost green. His face seemed to have grown suddenly thinner, perhaps in a single night, for I had seen him looking as usual only 2 days before. The president began with asking the court whether all the jury were present. But I see I can't go on like this, partly because some things I did not hear, others I did not notice, and others I have forgotten, but most of all because, as I have said before, I have literally no time or space to mention everything that was said and done. I only know that neither side objected to very many of the jurymen. I remember the 12 jurymen, 4 were petty officials of the town, 2 were merchants, and 6 peasants and artisans of the town. I remember, long before the trial, questions were continually asked with some surprise, especially by ladies, can such a delicate, complex and psychological case be submitted for decision to petty officials and even peasants? And what can an official, still more a peasant, understand in such an affair? All the 4 officials in the jury were, in fact, men of no consequence and of low rank. Except one who was rather younger, they were grey-headed men, little known in society, who had vegetated on a pitiful salary, and who probably had elderly, unpresentable wives and crowds of children, perhaps even without shoes and stockings. At most, they spent their leisure over cards and, of course, had never read a single book. The two merchants looked respectable, but were strangely silent and stolid. One of them was close, shaven, and was dressed in European style, the other had a small, grey beard, and wore a red ribbon with some sort of a medal upon it on his neck. There is no need to speak of the artisans and the peasants. The artisans of Skotoprigonivsk are almost peasants, and even work on the land. Two of them also wore European dress, and, perhaps for that reason, were dirtier and more uninviting, looking than the others. So that one might well wonder, as I did as soon as I had looked at them, what men like that could possibly make of such a case. Yet their faces made a strangely imposing, almost menacing, impression. They were stern and frowning. At last the president opened the case of the murder of Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov. I don't quite remember how he described him. The court usher was told to bring in the prisoner, and Mitya made his appearance. There was a hush through the court. One could have heard a fly. I don't know how it was with others, but Mitya made a most unfavorable impression on me. He looked an awful dandy in a brand new frock coat. I heard afterwards that he had ordered it in Moscow expressly for the occasion from his own tailor, who had his measure. He wore immaculate black kid gloves and exquisite linen. He walked in with his yard, long strides, looking stiffly straight in front of him, and sat down in his place with a most unperturbed air. At the same moment the counsel for defense, the celebrated Fetyukovich, entered, and a sort of subdued hum passed through the court. He was a tall, spare man, with long thin legs, with extremely long, thin, pale fingers, clean, shaven face, demurely brushed, rather short hair, and thin lips that were at times curved into something between a sneer and a smile. He looked about 40. His face would have been pleasant, if it had not been for his eyes, which, in themselves small and inexpressive, were set remarkably close together, with only the thin, long nose as a dividing line between them. In fact, there was something strikingly bird-like about his face. He was in evening dress and white tie. I remember the president's first questions to Mitya, about his name, his calling, and so on. Mitya answered sharply, and his voice was so unexpectedly loud that it made the president start and look at the prisoner with surprise. Then followed a list of persons who were to take part in the proceedings, that is, of the witnesses and experts. It was a long list. Four of the witnesses were not present: Musov, who had given evidence at the preliminary inquiry, but was now in Paris, Madame Holokov and Maximov, who were absent through illness, and Smerdyakov, through his sudden death, of which an official statement from the police was presented. The news of Smerdyakov's death produced a sudden stir and whisper in the court. Many of the audience, of course, had not heard of the sudden suicide. What struck people most was Mitya's sudden outburst. As soon as the statement of Smerdyakov's death was made, he cried out aloud from his place, "He was a dog and died like a dog." I remember how his counsel rushed to him, and how the president addressed him, threatening to take stern measures, if such an irregularity were repeated. Mitya nodded and in a subdued voice repeated several times abruptly to his counsel, with no show of regret, "I won't again, I won't. It escaped me. I won't do it again." And, of course, this brief episode did him no good with the jury or the public. His character was displayed, and it spoke for itself. It was under the influence of this incident that the opening statement was read. It was rather short, but circumstantial. It only stated the chief reasons why he had been arrested, why he must be tried, and so on. Yet it made a great impression on me. The clerk read it loudly and distinctly. The whole tragedy was suddenly unfolded before us, concentrated, in bold relief, in a fatal and pitiless light. I remember how, immediately after it had been read, the president asked Mitya in a loud impressive voice, "Prisoner, do you plead guilty?" Mitya suddenly rose from his seat. I plead guilty to drunkenness and dissipation, he exclaimed, again in a startling, almost frenzied, voice, to idleness and debauchery.